J. Feeney is the first case, S. Feeney is the second case. I was so interested in the Feeney case, I skipped the Perkins case. I apologize. But it sure did give people in the Feeney case a warning, didn't it? Commonwealth versus Perkins is to be called by the clerk.
Commonwealth versus Perkins, John I. Jones, the Board's Assistant Attorney General, Appellant Counsel, Charles E. Hayden, Appellee's Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones, and I represent the Commonwealth, the appellant in this case. If it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. As you can tell from the last argument, sometimes that doesn't happen.
I certainly understand.
I'll try to help you.
Thank you. The Court of Appeals was bound to affirm the trial court's decision if the evidence supported any rational fact finder in determining that the evidence supported a finding of intent. And instead, it impermissibly reweighed the evidence, substituting its judgment for that of the trial court on that point. So accordingly, its judgment must be reversed. It is elementary that a person intends the natural and probable consequences of his actions, and that that intent must often be inferred from those actions. This court considered in Burkeen a case that involved a single blow, a single blow from a fist, malicious wounding case, and whether the evidence in that case supported the trial court's finding of intent, and it found that it did. In the course of that, this court considered the unprovoked nature of the attack, the surprise nature of the attack, and the fact that that left the victim defenseless.
Counsel, may I ask you this? The Court of Appeals pointed out in its opinion that there were two assailants that attacked the victim in this case, and seemed to place some weight on that fact, and we're not sure who did what and who was responsible for what. What difference might that make to our analysis?
If anything, I think that it makes it demonstrates the intent was worse, Your Honor, because it's in the context of a coordinated attack, and that made the potential for serious and permanent injury more serious. It made it, and it also demonstrated that this wasn't sort of an accidental injury. I think concert of action comes into this to some extent, and part of the problem with the way that this argument has progressed up through the system is that this really wasn't argued before the Court of Appeals to any great extent. Intent on malicious wounding did not, it didn't get any serious attention in the briefing.
Who delivered the blow to the head of the victim with the handgun?
That was Perkins. That was the defendant in this case.
So if we just analyze that, it's unsuspected, unprovoked, defenseless. It was a vulnerable area of the body, and the force of the blow probably was pretty hard. It opened up its scalp. Why do we even need to look at the other guy?
I don't think that we do, Your Honor, but to the extent that the Court of Appeals appeared to consider it, I think that it came to the wrong result. The fact that it was in concert with Williams didn't make it better for Perkins's intent.
As you say, arguably worse. They were obviously acting together, unless they just both spontaneously, out of nowhere, came up with the idea, why don't we assault this guy from behind?
Yes,
you hit him with the gun, and I'll take him down with my fist.
Yes, Your Honor. And the fact that the blows came almost simultaneously, if you read White's testimony, would seem to belie that sort of a possibility and make it even more remote than it naturally would seem. But again, the Burkeen factors, I think, are very instructive in this case, because here we have it is just as unprovoked. It is a surprise. It's probably more surprising than it was for the victim in Burkeen, because where in Burkeen the victim was facing the defendant and at least saw the punch coming, here White was struck in the back and side of the head. in the back of the head was with the handgun.
He was knocked unconscious, right?
He was knocked unconscious.
The blow was with sufficient force to affect that outcome.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, that goes, I think, to the natural and probable consequences of a blow with a handgun in the back of the head that is hard enough to knock him out. The natural and probable consequences of that is a permanent injury. You're looking at a pretty strong probability, I think, of brain damage. And we see that...
Well, why do you say that? There's a strong possibility of brain damage when there wasn't any here. And
well,
just getting hit on the head doesn't mean you always get brain damage.
And perhaps I misspoke, Your Honor, but the head is a vulnerable area, and it's a special area because it carries the brain. And we see here that he was struck very hard with the gun. He was essentially pistol whipped in the back of the head. And so that is certainly probative of his intent.
What is the intent that has to be proof? Just that he acted with malice, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's a wrongful state of mind without any kind of justification and so on, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that there has been some discussion in the case law that the intent must be to permanently injure as opposed to temporarily injure. But the issue here is whether there was sufficient evidence for the trial court to find that that intent was present. And it was, Your Honor. I mean, there certainly on this record, it cannot be said that no reasonable fact finder, no rational fact finder could have found that intent.
The other thing that we need to talk about is the Court of Appeals opinion just focused on disability, but the statute applies to disjunctives, maiming, disfigurement, and disability. And while they are very closely related, they have different common law definitions.
Yes, Your Honor. That's true. And I another problem with the Court of Appeals' panel decision here is that the analysis is pretty conclusory. It's difficult to really grasp exactly what factors they're looking at and coming to their conclusion, except to say that we can't say that the evidence was sufficient. They talk about the fact that Williams and Perkins worked together, I think that the opinion sort of short circuits the analysis of how you get from A to B, and so it's difficult to pick it apart. But it is clear from the opinion that it disregarded the fair inference that the trial court drew from the evidence before it, and so for that reason, it erred.
Did the Court of Appeals mention Burkeen or analyze the factors in Burkeen?
It did not, Your Honor. And again, I think that that's probably because it wasn't fairly before the court. The parties hadn't briefed Burkeen. It hadn't been a serious issue that was raised by the appellant's brief, by Perkins' brief in the Court of Appeals. And so there wasn't a whole lot of argument before the Court of Appeals to determine this. But here, in this posture that we're in now, we can consider more fully the implications of Burkeen and other cases like it. And to the extent that one could argue that Perkins' intent was to get money rather than to injure White, that sort of an argument would confuse motive and intent. And motive is the moving cause which induces action, while intent is the purpose to use a particular means to effectuate that result. So it's perfectly clear, or it seems clear from this record, that the motive was to get White's money, but that doesn't preclude a finding that the means by which he intended to do that was by injuring, maliciously wounding White. And for support for that, we look to Dominguez versus Pruitt, and it quotes Banovich versus Commonwealth in that case. Perkins was, the Court of Appeals was bound to affirm the trial court if the evidence could have supported any rational fact finder in finding intent. And it failed to do so. So for those reasons, we ask that the court would reverse the Court of Appeals' opinion and reinstate Perkins' convictions. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless the court has additional questions.
All right, you have 6 minutes.
It pleases the court. The evidence did indicate that the co-defendant, according to the victim, testifies that the co-defendant Williams struck me on the right side of the face. At the same time as I was being struck by the co-defendant, that's when I got hit in the back of the head with something. I don't know how many times I was hit, because after the first hit, I was knocked out. So what we have is evidence from behind, the blow from the back of the head, presumably with the gun that that knocks out the victim. There's no other evidence that my client did anything other than inflict this blow from behind. And the Court of Appeals noted that the trial court found the credible White's testimony, the victim's testimony, that Perkins struck White in the head with a gun from behind. And all the Court of Appeals noted that although the force of this blow was sufficient to injure White, one cannot say that this record contains sufficient evidence from which the trial court could have inferred an intent to cause permanent disability.
That one sentence appears to be the whole of the legal analysis, and Burkeen and the factors of Burkeen are not mentioned and applied. And the factors are, and I'm reading from Burkeen, an unsuspecting blow, a defenseless victim, a targeted area of the body, which in Burkeen was the head, and injuries to the head requiring medical attention. All those factors apply here, and they weren't even discussed. Why?
I don't have the answer to that. I presume that the Court of Appeals found that this is an offense. Malicious wounding requires a specific intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. And in this case, a single blow from behind, and that's all we can really say Perkins did, can we say that single blow was intended to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill?
May I ask you this? The statute says disable. So if I hit someone, I may not have the intent to inflict a permanent disability, as in someone in a vegetative state or they can't use their arm or something like that. I want to disable them in the sense of render them inoperative even briefly. So if I knock someone in the back of the head and I conk them out and they're there on the floor, have I not disabled them? That seems like a plain language application of the term disable.
With respect,
does the case law foreclose that interpretation? Does it have to be a permanent disability?
Well, I would respectfully submit that that's a very expansive use of the term disable. One could say that any sort of assault and battery is intended to disable the victim to then proceed to rob them or do somehow make them acquiescent to whatever the assailant's demands are.
But unconscious is different than harming someone. I'm angry, I'm in a bar, and we're in a fist fight, and we're just trying to hurt each other or whatever. But to disable in the sense of knock unconscious
might mean disable in the sense of cause the ceasing of any resistance. And of course, this is a penal statute. We can't just apply these definitions of the word disable.
But let me focus my question. Does our case law foreclose a reading of disable in that way, to just render unconscious altogether?
I would submit that expansive use of or definition of the word disable would not be supported by the case law. I think traditionally, when the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill has been defined, it's never been just simply disabled from resisting compelling acquiescence as the meaning of a disabled.
Well, I just listened carefully to your answer. Respecting that answer, whether I agree with it or not, I follow it immediately by distinguishing Burkeen.
Well, I would be have difficulty doing that. And I have to acknowledge.
I mean, whether one likes Burkeen or not, and apparently the Court of Appeals doesn't, it's the law of the Commonwealth. And there doesn't seem to be a dime's worth of difference between this case and Burkeen. Except this defendant hit him with a gun rather than with a bare hand. So he actually was holding a weapon. Okay, thank
Can't
you.
Can't disagree with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have 6 minutes.
Your Honor, to the question of whether what precise specific intent is necessary to convict of malicious wounding, in Burkeen there's a discussion about that, and I'll read straight from the opinion. It says the Court of Appeals has stated, to be guilty of malicious wounding, a person must also intend to permanently, not merely temporarily, harm another person, and cites to a Court of Appeals case, Johnson. We agree with the ruling of the Court of Appeals in Johnson. So, I mean, to the extent that that is an open question, I think that this court probably settled it in Burkeen, that the specific intent when you're looking at disable must be to permanently rather than temporarily harm someone. However, there was sufficient evidence before the trial court to, and we know in Burkeen, the court went on to find that the evidence before the trial court in that case was sufficient to support the trial court's finding that what had happened in Burkeen evinced an intent to permanently injure. And again, that was with a single blow with a fist, targeted at a vulnerable area, without any warning, without any provocation, and resulting in serious injuries.
But also in Burkeen, the assailant also bragged about how strong he was and how he knew he could hurt the guy the way he did it, and things like that, and then he attacked someone else who prevented him from inflicting further damage on the victim. Don't you think those facts are relevant?
I think they're relevant, but I don't think that they're enough to distinguish the result here from the result in Burkeen. In Burkeen, it seemed like that the real focal points were the nature of the attack and how they demonstrated. And again, it is a totality of the evidence analysis, but I think that the important facts in Burkeen that the court really focused on were, you know, again, that we've been over them, but the nature of the attack, how it was a surprise, extreme force against an unsuspecting victim.
Right, and let me go back to that, too, because in Burkeen, honestly, my recollection is it was a sucker punch.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the guy was just talking to him, he just, you know, and yes, then was laughing about it and bragging about it, et cetera. Whereas in this case, my recollection is that the victim turned around and saw the guy trying to hit him or something, and he was thinking, well, I'm with his mom, I can't imagine he's really going to hit me.
Yes,
well,
yes,
he hit him. You know, he saw that he was going to hit him. I mean, and then he kind of like was hoping that he wouldn't, but he did.
Yeah, and Your Honor, that evidence was before the trial court, and it resolved it in favor of White's testimony being credible. And so the Court of Appeals was bound by that, and it instead, again, substituted its own judgment for that of the trial court. And so because that's the case, I think that this court should reverse the finding of the Court of Appeals. And again, the test at this stage is whether there was sufficient evidence to support the trial court's finding that there was intent, and whether any reasonable fact finder or any rational fact finder could have found that those inferences were supported by the evidence. And because the Court of Appeals failed to employ the correct standard of review in coming to its decision, whenever we look at this case against Burkeen and against Dominguez versus Pruitt, I think that I know that that's a habeas case, but I think that the analysis there is instructive as an additional guidepost, because it does talk about sufficiency of the evidence. And so in view of this court's guidance that it's given, I think that the Court of Appeals clearly erred in its decision. So we would ask again that the court would just reverse the Court of Appeals panel decision and reinstate Mr. Perkins' convictions. Thank you.
Madam Clerk, call both of the next cases.